I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of April. What would a majority of the American public decide if given the opportunity to make their own defense budget? Is there a wellspring of support for increasing the defense budget to which officials and presidential candidates are responding or not? The nonpartisan organization Voice of the People has done another survey looking at right-sizing defense, the perspective of the people. It's an in-depth survey of the citizen cabinet nationally and in California, Florida, Maryland, New York, Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, and Virginia. The defense budget has been a major focus of discussion over the last few years, and there is pressure to raise the defense budget in Congress. We're going to be talking about this Voice of the People survey and about the issues that the candidates have expressed when it comes to defense spending, and also a look at where we are spending money in our defense budget. So we have two guests with us during the course of this hour. We start with Bradley Penniston. Bradley is deputy editor of Defense One, a national security journalist. He's been for 20 years. He helped launch military.com, served as managing editor of Defense News, and was editor of Armed Forces Journal. He's written two books about the U.S. Navy, including No Higher Honor, Saving the USS Samuel B. Roberts in the Persian Gulf, which is now part of the Chief of Naval Operations Professional Reading Program. Later in the hour, Stephen Cull, who's founder and president of Voice of the People. He's director of the Program for Public Consultation in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we ask you the question, what do you think about the amount of money we spend on defense? Should we be cutting certain kinds of programs? You'll also learn about certain weapons systems and whether or not the people in this survey that we'll be discussing think that they should be increased the amount of money we spend for those or decreased. So all hour, we welcome your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your messages there, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Bradley, hello. Thanks ever so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here, Kathleen.
Where do we stand now in terms of what the 2017 budget is as proposed by the president, what Congress has said about how much money they would like to increase or decrease for defense? Are we seeing rising amounts or lowering amounts?
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit up, not much. The trend over the past few years has been a cut, thanks to the 2011 Budget Control Act that essentially did a salami slice across the entire federal budget. And then in the past few years, we've seen agreements between the White House and Congress that has allowed spending to drift up just a little bit over inflation. So that's about where we are. I think, important just to realize for context that we still outspend everybody else in the world by a good margin, and especially if you stack up all the spending on by our NATO allies, then we outspend everybody who is even conceivably an adversary by quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. You've written about the president, and this seems like a fairly large spike, asking for a 35% spike in cybersecurity funding in a recent piece that you wrote. What is that for? Is he likely to get it?
Well, everybody is concerned about cybersecurity. I mean, every week, almost every day, you see a new data breach. There's, you know, the big Sony hack of last year. There was the big Office of Personnel Management hack, where so many documents of federal employees got stolen, possibly by China. And so, cybersecurity, network security, is a really, really big priority. So I think if anything increases in this budget while the Congress debates it, it'll probably be that.
What about money to fight ISIS?
Same thing. The president has signaled that he wants to, quote, accelerate the war against ISIS. And I think everybody is on board with that. At least I haven't heard anything out of Congress that indicates that anybody thinks that is not a priority. So I think that that is That's probably going to happen as well.
Mm-hmm. And it, because we're in this presidential election, which is gobbling all of our news time, we haven't heard a lot about what's been going on in Syria, what's been going on with the refugee situation. You draw attention to that in a recent newsletter. There is a new refugee outflow to the border of with Turkey, Syrian border with Turkey, people who are leaving besieged cities. That refugee crisis must be huge. Is there money in a defense budget for dealing with that crisis or not? Does that come somewhere else?
In as much as the U.S. does have a presence in the Mediterranean, does have a presence, you know, in the Middle East, does have a presence in Europe, the U.S. can help with that sort of thing. But I think it's my impression, at least, that most of the day-to-day, workaday dealing with refugees, you know, is being done by the European navies and coast guards as, you know, boats come across the Mediterranean. They're out there, you know, trying to do what they can to make sure that people are safe, whether that's turning them back or at least getting them to shore, rescuing them when the boats founder, that sort of thing. But I think that is being handled more by our European allies rather than by the U.S. military itself.
Are there calls in Congress for an increased amount of money, or any money, actually, to put combat troops in this area?
Well, there's always people who want everything.
Right.
I think nobody is, I was going to say nobody's really spoiling for a fight, but, you know, calls in Congress. Ted Cruz thinks that we should have a more robust policy against ISIS. He thinks that he is more interventionist on that. He, for one, has been calling for more.
Mm-hmm. Afghanistan. How many troops are in Afghanistan? What's the plan? Are we increasing the amount of money there?
We are increasing it. The troops have drifted up, but the plan still is to draw them down entirely. Afghanistan is not as fluid as the Iraq situation is right now. We are increasing the number of troops we're sending back to Iraq. Every week there's sort of a new drib or drab. Okay, we have a fire base in Iraq now where U.S. advisors are helping the Iraqi security forces in their fight against the Islamic State. We reported recently that they're talking about increasing the number of fire bases. And again, at this point at least, unlike in Syria, we're not talking about getting directly involved. We're talking about increasing the number of advisors that we have kept in Iraq, the sort of rump of the big deployment we did in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Building up and providing, you wrote about, more intelligence to regional forces working to counter violent extremist groups and their affiliates in northern Africa. Tell me about those efforts, and is there also a call for providing more intelligence to regional forces fighting, I don't even know what regional forces they are in Syria that are fighting ISIS and in other areas fighting Al-Qaeda, et cetera?
Well, one of the tenets of U.S. national security policy is now and always has been trying to build up what's called partner capacity. And so this essentially means helping other people help themselves. So Iraq right now, as I just mentioned, the advisors that we have. Okay, so we trained the Iraqi military, and yet it still needs a little bit of help. So we've got people on the ground, uniformed service members on the ground there, trying to help the Iraqis figure out what to do. And so intelligence is part of this. You want to give our partners, wherever they may be and whoever their adversaries may be, you want to give them the information, the data, the real-time situational awareness that they need to go out and defeat whoever it is they're fighting. The question always is, how much do you give? We've seen so many instances in Iraq and Afghanistan of infiltrators from ISIS or infiltrators from the Taliban or traitors from the government forces or, you know, people who are just, you know, trying to make a living and accept a payoff for a little bit of information, this whole range. But what happens is you have to be careful where you give the intelligence because it might slip out the back door and get right back to the enemy. So mm-hmm. That's the perennial hope is building partner capacity, and that's the perennial challenge is making sure that you're not actually helping the enemy as well.
And how successful have we been, Bradley, in gathering intelligence on these groups?
More and more. I mean, our intelligence capabilities grow every year. We figure out how to do it better every year. About five or six years ago, started learning really how to attack these, you could say, network-enabled forces, non-hierarchical enemies, terrorist groups that don't have a table of organization the way the U.S. military does. They're very flexible. They're very quick. And so we finally figured out that, in the words of one general, it takes a network to defeat a network. And what this means is you have to have you can't have everything go up the chain of command and come back down the chain of command. You've got to empower the people out there on the front lines and in the midst of the fight to gather the information and then act very quickly. So this is this was pretty much an immediate success when they started doing it, and certainly it took some time to tweak the details, but more and more it's the way we are operating overseas. When we deploy forces, especially special forces, special operations forces, we are doing it in a sort of network-enabled way where we allow other folks to gather the intelligence and then act on it rather than constantly pushing the decision, back away from the front lines to regional headquarters, sometimes even to Washington. We're getting better at finding a bit of information, figuring out where the target is, and then going after it.
Many people actually will look at, let's go back to Afghanistan, the number of years that we have been in that country. It is a long, long time now. How much of the country is in the hands of Taliban? Are insurgents gaining more ground, losing more ground? Are we making any headway in that country?
Well, it's an excellent question. And we put out a morning newsletter called The Debrief, and we quoted another report on saying that the Taliban had, a majority of the territory in Afghanistan under their control. And we got major pushback on that from Central Command, U.S. Central Command, who said, no, that's not right. But a lot of it depends on how you define control. Certainly we're not talking about armies that occupy ground and maybe what we might call the traditional notions of controlling ground. What does it mean to really control ground? It is the beginning of the Afghan fighting season, as they call it. It kicked off a little bit early this week. And so we'll see. We're in for another summer of fighting. It's not stopping, and we'll just have to see how things go.
Now, I must say, I had never heard of this before, Bradley, so tell us about it. You reported a couple of months ago that the Army has made a robot cockroach that could be the next big thing in intelligence collection.
Well, so...
So what is that?
It is essentially a little tiny robot with sensors on it that you could send scuttling into a building, and so you could get eyes and ears on what's going inside. And it's really just one of dozens, perhaps even hundreds, of different form factors of sensors. The U.S. military and really all modern militaries run on intelligence. The U.S. military has gone farther than anybody else yet in figuring out how to figure out what's going on. And a lot of it is through new robotic means. Satellites have been around for decades, but our satellites are getting better all the time. But they are way up in space. You can't see into a house with them. Drones were the big things. Unmanned aerial vehicles, they really came into their own in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars that began more than a decade ago. Those are now give us persistent eyes in the sky above whatever little plot of ground we're trying to keep track of. But you can go further. You can get down to sensors on the ground. You can get down to, these cockroaches that maybe can get into the building next to you so you can see what you get. You can even get down to what's called smart dust. And these are tiny, tiny sensors that you wouldn't even see if you scattered them on a road, but which can keep an ear or an eye or, a motion sensor. Keep these sensors up and tell you and your team when they detect something. So the entire range, it's all about trying to get more information to the warfighter more quickly.
Bradley Penniston is our guest, the first part of the show, deputy editor of Defense One. He's been a national security journalist for over 20 years now, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. We want to move into a discussion of where the presidential candidates stand on defense spending. If they're singling certain programs that need a boost in spending or a decrease in spending, who's been most outspoken, how widely this has been discussed on the campaign trail, and we'll take phone calls for Bradley. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. If you could make your own defense budget, would you increase spending? Would you decrease spending? And why is the course of the conversation this hour? And we are talking about it partially because we've talked with these people before. There's a nonpartisan organization, Voice of the People, centered at the University of Maryland, and they have done a survey of citizens and titled their survey, Looking at Right-Sizing Defense, the Perspective of the People. We will be speaking with the director of that organization later in this show. So we go to your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to some phone calls now for Bradley Penniston, and we start with Casey in Green Bay. Hi, Casey. Hi, Casey.
Well, good afternoon, and I'd like to say hello to your guests, and I sincerely appreciate his expertise. I would like to make some quick comments, not get too long-winded. Number one, we do not use the term firebase in Iraq or Syria. That changed after the Marines were attacked 2 weeks ago. They use a Arabic term, but they do not, especially the Marines, they do not use the term firebase anymore because it gives the illusion that we're back into a combat mode. Number two, I know your guest is intelligent enough to know that we probably have more troops in the continent of Africa now than we do in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan combined, especially in the country of Djibouti, Ethiopia, Somalia. We probably have more active duty military in the continent of Africa, extremely due to the Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, Boko Haram, Abu Sayyaf. Africa is going to be our next hotspot. And when President Obama was elected 7.5 years ago, he was under the assumption, and I give him credit for thinking about trying to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan will still be going on when whoever the next president is for the next 8 years. President Obama learned the hard way. It's not easy to end a war once you start it. I give him credit for trying, but the war will still be going on 8 years from now. And maybe in a smaller base, but it'll certainly still be going on. You cannot kill a thought process like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban has, or ISIS. You can't kill that.
Casey, thanks for the call. Bradley.
We've got latest figures that I have for, this is the Army only, but we've got about 1,700 soldiers, that is Army folks, in Africa, and we've got about 20,000 in Afghanistan and the rest of the Middle East. So the caller certainly, though, is right that Africa is a growing focus for the U.S. military. And in particular, everybody is trying to decide what to do about Libya. Libya is, of course, a growing hotbed of ISIS and other extremist influence. And so the question there is, what, if anything, can the U.S. military do about it? We've had special operations forces kind of sneak in and sneak out, and mostly for recon. But, you know, again, like I said earlier, the dream always is that we get our partners to help themselves. And so one of the things that special forces do is help advise and train partner militaries and partner security forces. That's what's going on all over Africa, and they're thinking about doing more of it in Libya as well.
One of the things that we'll learn the second hour is that overall, from this extensive survey of what citizens think about the defense budget, there are calls for slight increases in some parts of the budget, but overall not a call for a majority of people in increasing the defense budget. When you look at the presidential candidates, do you find, Bradley, that they're all over the place when it comes to increasing or decreasing the amount of defense? Are there certain things that candidates have said that are particularly striking?
Well, it's striking, first of all, that we've arrived with, let's say four major candidates, all apologies to Governor Kasich. But you have You have Hillary Clinton, who has not explicitly called for more defense spending, but who vows to keep the U.S., the U.S. military, the best equipped, the strongest in the world. You have Donald Trump, who basically says the same thing. He says, in fact, that Trump does not say the same thing as Clinton. Trump says that our military has become hollowed out, and he is going to boost it so much that nobody will ever mess with us again. You have Cruz, who has a very detailed plan to rebuild the military, goes down to talk about the number of soldiers he wants, the number of naval warships he wants, the number of Air Force aircraft he wants, very detailed numbers for where he wants to get to. And then, of course, you have Bernie Sanders, who at one point in his career called for cutting Pentagon spending in half. Mm. Now, he's backed off of that, and now he just says that we need to take a hard look at spending. But that's where he's coming from. An interesting factoid I looked while looking up Sanders' record is that no Democrat has actually called for cutting Pentagon spending even as much as 10%. Since George McGovern in 1972. Nevertheless, it's an interesting run because we do have people who are actually we've candidates who are actually taking different stands in more or less detail.
Hmm. Casey, thanks for your call. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. Is all of the spending on the books, and that we were never able to find out what the war in Afghanistan and Iraq ever cost, particularly? Yeah.
That's a good question.
Right. So if the question is, do we know exactly how much the Pentagon spends? We know pretty much the big number. We know what the defense budget is each year, and as well we know how much the president requests extra each year. This is called the Overseas Contingency Operations Account, and it's essentially supposed to be for things you didn't anticipate, like wars that you didn't put into your earlier budget but now have broken out. That's not always exactly how it gets used, but that's the idea. So we know how much is spent on the military, pretty much. What we don't know are a lot of the inner workings, let me explain what I mean. It has been a long-held goal of many good government types and even people in the Pentagon to try to audit the Pentagon's books. That is, to come out at the end of the year and say, okay, we could go back and look at the Pentagon's ledgers and we could figure out exactly where all this money went. And they have never been able to do that. They managed to do it for the Marine Corps briefly, but couldn't keep that up. The other services have not been audible for many, many years, if they ever have indeed. So the question is yes or no. Is it on, do we know how much we're spending? Pretty much, but there's also a lot of murkiness as well.
Thanks, Kenneth. Michael in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I have a question, and I'm not sure how to ask it, but I'm going to try to ask it in a general way. Defense spending and war spending is really part of the discretionary budget. It is not a mandatory spending, and it doesn't really have a mandatory revenue connected to it. And we have candidates like Ted Cruz that are calling for more spending, but they are, at least from him, I've heard no indication of how he's going to cover that increased spending. And the spending right now is, like I said, part of the discretionary budget. It doesn't have a revenue source. So I'd like to hear what your guest mm-hmm. has to say about that. I would like to see a defense tax. I'd like to hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
So Ted Cruz has a page on his campaign site called Rebuild the Military, and this is where he goes into detail about the various things he wants to increase in the military. And he also has a couple paragraphs about how he will pay for these increases. And this falls into, I guess, two broad categories. One, he's going to cut government programs, and he doesn't detail that on the Rebuild the Military site, but he says that he can save on the order of $100 billion through cutting programs. And he also talks about jump-starting the economy. He wants to, quote-unquote, sweeping tax and regulatory reform. He doesn't explain what that is. But again, he says that if you just change the tax structure, presumably eliminate regulations, you can boost the economy perhaps up to 5% growth. And once you do that, then you have more money to play around with, and you should put it toward the military, is what he's saying. So if you want to know more, you can go to Ted's site and look it up yourself.
One more call for you, then, same topic, different guest. Claire in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I hope this is a perfect guest to ask this question of. I'm concerned about waste in the military, and I remember years back stories of $800 toilet seats and crazy things like that. And there was a spy plane of some sort that turned out to be a totally ridiculous waste of money. If I recall right, it was $1 trillion. And no branch of the military liked this new plane that got built. Nobody wanted it in the first place. And so there's a huge, huge waste of taxpayer dollars. Do we have any handle on how much money is, quote-unquote, wasted in our military?
So it's a good question. And all of the candidates say that they are against waste. Hillary Clinton, as a matter of fact, says that she is for setting up a commission to investigate waste in the military. Of course, the various Armed Services Committee of Congress are supposed to do this anyway, but a little bit more attention couldn't hurt, I suppose. As far as just screw up waste, the services are still, you know, losing billions of dollars of stuff a year that they can't account for. It's connected to the problem of books and auditability and just being the world's largest enterprise and moving a whole lot of stuff around. You lose stuff, and so there's undoubtedly waste of that sort. But that kind of thing pales in comparison to the amount of money we deliberately spend on programs. And then it's not a question so much as waste as of judgment. I'm not quite sure what airplane you're talking about, but certainly one currently controversial airplane is called the F-35 Lightning II, or the Joint Strike Fighter. Mm-hmm. And the Pentagon swears up and down that this new advanced fighter is what the military needs to maintain air superiority over all conceivable enemies for the next decades. Other people look at it and say, oh, my God, it's slow. It doesn't measure up to its specs. It doesn't carry enough. It's not stealthy enough. It can't fly far enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So is that a waste, or is that just what you have to accept in order to get a plane that is up to 21st century specs? It's a judgment call, and right now you have you have the military on one side and you have critics on the other. Bernie Sanders thinks it's a waste. Ted Cruz thinks it's a great plane, and so forth.
And interestingly enough, we will turn to the survey that we've mentioned where majorities nationally and in all states endorsed canceling the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program and instead upgrading current fighters, which they say would save $6 billion in the near term and $97 billion through 2037. Thank you ever so much for being with us. Please return. We need to talk to you again before the election, Bradley.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and it'll be my pleasure to come back on. Thanks
Great.
So much.
Thank you. Bradley Penniston, deputy editor of Defense One. He's been a national security journalist for 20 years, launched military.com, served as managing editor of Defense News, was editor of Armed Forces Journal, and has written two books about the U.S. Navy. Now we move into the Voice of the People. It's a national nonpartisan organization. We've been in touch with them on other surveys. The latest one is looking at right-sizing defense, the perspective of the people, an in-depth survey. We'll hear about how it was done, and we are pleased to welcome back to the program Stephen Cull, who is founder and president of Voice of the People. He's a political psychologist and is director of the Program for Public Consultation, School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. For 20 years, he has conducted in-depth studies of public opinion on public policy. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us again. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you did this. This is one of those issues that people care about, I think, pretty deeply, and the candidates are talking about a bit, but we care about it a lot, and there is a lot to look at. I thought your findings were interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's by far the the biggest item in the discretionary budget. It's about half of the entire discretionary budget.
Wow.
So, it's a major investment that we make as a nation, and people have concerns about it being too much, and they also have concerns about whether we have all the necessary capabilities to defend our interests.
Mm-hmm. So tell us again, for those not familiar with Voice of the People, how do you go about getting the citizens' thoughts on these issues?
Well, what we do is first we recruit a representative sample of registered voters nationwide and in some specific states. Right now we're in 8 specific states. And we take people through a process we call a policy-making simulation. And what we do there is we don't just ask, you know, should we increase or decrease defense spending? We give them some information about how much we're spending, how we're doing it, looking at it from different perspectives, and then they consider various options for changing, increasing, decreasing in the case of defense spending, and they evaluate pro and con arguments. So as they make decisions, they also get feedback about the impact of their choices. So, and when we did the defense budget one, there was a little clicker there, and when they made increases or decreases in their defense budget, they saw it so that they really could keep track of what they were doing overall. So we're trying to put people in the shoes of policymakers, and then they can actually give input to the real choice points that members of Congress are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we also asked about specific weapon systems,
yes.
And here again, they heard pro and con arguments, and then they weighed in on some specific weapon systems. Also, the operation in Afghanistan, they got to weigh in on that. And throughout, they're given a little background briefing on what the issues are, and they hear pro and con arguments. And all of this is vetted with congressional staffers from both parties, as well as various outside groups and experts. So we can be really confident that what they're getting is balanced, factual, accurate, and represents the full range of arguments that are in play.
Mm-hmm. Just the way you would hope that all voters would prepare for their big vote, right?
Mm-hmm. And we put the policy-making simulation online, and anybody can go online and go through the process. If you go to VOP.org, Voice of the People, on the front page you'll see something that says policy-making simulations. You can click that, and you can go through the entire process that the people in the Citizen Cabinet went through. And then at the end, you can summarize your conclusions, your recommendations, and you can send them right off to your members of Congress.
There you go. I like that. VOP.org. So on the large question, and then we'll break it down some, is there support for increasing the defense budget, or is there a lack of support for that? What was the overall finding?
There's not support for increasing the defense budget, and that's true of Republicans as well as Democrats. Democrats overall did reduce it. Independents did reduce it, not by a lot, but they did some. Republicans didn't either increase or decrease it. But you do find overall some desire to basically trim it a bit and downward. And they also cut some specific weapon systems, which we can come back to. But we are hearing a lot of talk about increasing the defense budget. All of the Republican candidates have called for it, and the president's budget calls for an increase for 2017, so there's a lot of talk in Washington about increasing it, but you don't find support for that.
Mm.
In the American public.
When you look at certain areas, there were majorities who said we should cut naval forces, nuclear weapons, missile defense, but a majority did not cut or increase spending on the Marine Corps or on special operations forces. How do you explain that?
Well, we took them through arguments for and against why each of these areas was particularly important, and arguments in favor of the value of the Marine Corps did very well, and the arguments against it didn't do so well. Special operations also got a very positive response. And I think when people think about what we're doing, when we think about dealing with crises in very localized crises, or dealing with terrorist groups, some situation like Afghanistan or say a possible situation in Syria, they think more of an intervening force that would go in and deal with the situation quickly, or they think of special ops that would go in and do more restricted operations. The kinds of scenarios people think of are not so much, you know, large ground forces, large air power, certainly not nuclear weapons, not big naval operations. So air power, ground forces, naval forces, nuclear weapons, these were trimmed. On a percentage basis, nuclear weapons were trimmed the most. They were trimmed 13%. The others were just, you know, trimmed just a little bit, a few percentage points, a few billion dollars each. But Marine Corps and Special Ops were not.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at some of the specific programs. We just talked about one of them a few minutes ago, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. Majorities nationally and in all states endorsed canceling that fighter program.
That's right. Not by a large majority, but you did have a majority in favor of canceling the F-35. That was true of 63% of Democrats and 54% of independents. However, you had 54% of Republicans opposing canceling it.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, tell me what this is, the next generation bomber, majorities nationally and in all states endorsed proceeding with the development of that.
Mm-hmm. This is now known as the B-21. There's talk, should we continue the process of developing it? It's certainly not ready for production. You had a majority, 56%, favoring continuing with the development of it, including two-thirds of Republicans and of 52% of independents. A slight majority of Democrats oppose that.
Hmm. Aircraft carriers.
Yeah, well, we now have 11 aircraft carriers, and there has been some talk about, do we really need 11? And so they heard the arguments for cutting them down, and they had the option of cutting to 10 or 9. That's kind of the range of discussion. And you had overall 60% wanted to reduce it at least from 11 to 10. Large, so 71% of Democrats and 61% of independents favored that. A slight majority of Republicans didn't favor it. But overall, you had a good, pretty solid 6 in 10 for reducing at least to 10 aircraft carriers.
And nuclear submarines.
Yeah, there's been an idea that maybe we should reduce we're getting these new nuclear strike submarines, and there's been talk about reducing the numbers on that, and that didn't go over. 54% opposed that.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, but before we pause for just a moment, Ed writes to us on Facebook, which is an interesting question. If one digs a bit, he says, I would guess the majority of people who support raising defense spending are from states that have large military contracts, often building items not even wanted or needed by the military leadership.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and one that comes to people's minds. So we did an analysis to see if that was true. And we broke the sample up based on what states people lived in, and we said, okay, let's look at the five states that have the most defense spending per capita, and then the next five, and the next five, and so on down. And guess what? There was no difference.
Really?
The states with the top five states in terms of defense spending per capita were a little lower than average. So statistically, you look at it overall, it was just there was no order there, and that proved to be true in other studies that we have done as well.
We go to phone calls. We're looking at a the latest in the Voice of the People survey, Right-Sizing Defense, the Perspective of the People. It's an in-depth survey of the citizen cabinet nationally and also in the states of California, Florida, Maryland, New York, Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, and Virginia. Our guest has been with us to talk about other surveys they have done. Stephen Cull is founder and president of Voice of the People. It's located at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's a political psychologist, and he has been conducting in-depth studies of public opinion on public policy. If you would like to take this yourself, which is an interesting thing to do, go to VOP.org, and you'll be able to take the survey to find out where you stand on this pretty important issue. So we ask you this hour of the program. We've already outlined what's in this. You may have certain programs in that you're concerned about. You may think that defense spending is much lower than it should be as we're fighting terrorism. You may think that defense spending should be in a certain direction. You can talk about that. Or there may be a presidential candidate and you find yourself really aligning with him or her because of what they've said on defense spending. We have time to take more phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter at KDunnShow. It's a large chunk of change for taxpayers, one half of the discretionary budget. Is it about the right amount? Do you think it should be less? Why do you think that? We'll go to you. Please call in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our number, 800-486-8655. We have this email that has come in from Lucas, Stephen, who says the budget for defense spending is good right where it is. What we should do, he says, is have more scrutiny on how we spend that money because there seems to be plenty of it.
Well, that's a very common concern, and when we gave people pro and con arguments on spending, the argument for reducing spending that by far got the strongest level of support, the largest number saying that it was a convincing argument, 8 and 10, was that there's a lot of waste in the system. There are a lot of cost overruns. There are decisions that are made for political reasons, like keeping bases open, things like that. And Americans don't necessarily know exactly what to do about it. And apparently, the government doesn't know that much what to do about it either, as your previous previous guest said. But it's very much something that bothers people.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're asking you to be kind of a participant in the survey as well, though not extensive. Defense spending, about where it should be higher, should be lower. Jim in Eau Claire, hi. Jim?
Hello, hi, yes. Hi, Kathleen. Just a quick response to even the first one and the second one. I'm aware of two naval carrier, whether aircraft or naval ships, one being built in Louisiana and one being built in Maine, neither of which were requested by the respective units, and yet they're being built. Appears to be totally political, and I'm looking at waste, how people respond and how you have access to respond to those kinds of situations.
Yes, that definitely does happen. There are weapons programs that the Pentagon says we don't really need that, but Congress proceeds to fund them, and it's clearly driven by the fact that cutting the program would result in some jobs lost, and there are members of Congress in those states and districts that have influence. And the programs continue, and this is one of the considerations that contributes to the public feeling that there is so much waste, and that a lot of the decisions are For example, in the argument, we said, this, I'm reading from it, there's much waste in the national defense budget. Members of Congress often approve unnecessary spending for their districts or keep unneeded bases open just to benefit their own supporters. And 8 in 10 Americans find that convincing. And this includes 7 in 10 Republicans as well as 86% Democrats. And this is true in all of the states that that we surveyed in.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim. Rick in Grafton. Hi.
Hi. My comment is that, you know, these kids are out there fighting these wars. Whether you agree with the war or not, we should definitely take care of them because, you know, they're just doing their job. And that's my comment.
Thank you, Rick.
Yes, the Americans are very much care for the people who are in the service, and they certainly don't want to cut back in any way that would in some way put them at greater peril or put some new economic pressure on them. So when they think in terms of cutting, they think more of cutting programs and weapons systems and things like that. There was some support for cutting ground forces. We didn't specifically ask about the number or anything like that, but there was support for cutting $4 billion. A majority favored that, which would be about a 3% cut. But that's more the numbers, not anything about, you know, cutting their pay or anything like that.
Thanks, Rick. Deborah in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hi. I had a question about funding for veterans and their health care and things like that. I don't know if that's a separate thing from the defense budget or if that's part of the defense budget. And if it's part of it, then why doesn't more money go to that? Because it always seems to me that I'm reading another article about how, you know, veterans aren't able to get care when they get back to the United States for various reasons.
That is not part of the defense budget. That is part of the discretionary budget, but it has its own line item. And it's just to give you some perspective, that's about $59 billion that goes to veterans benefits as compared to more than $500 for the defense budget overall.
I would imagine there would be overwhelming support for money for veterans.
There isn't support for increasing it.
Really?
But there's not support for any significant cuts.
When you look at the presidential candidates, which we talked about earlier and what their stands are on the military, did you find that certain respondents were aligning themselves closely with the philosophy of one of the candidates versus another and went a certain way on their vote because of their support?
Well, we didn't ask why they were voting for any particular candidate in these terms. So one thing we did do was we asked people who they prefer, who they would like to see become president. And then we looked at what kind of defense budget they made up. And there were significant differences, as you might imagine. Now, interestingly, there was no set of supporters that favored an increase. However, among supporters of Cruz, Rubio, and Trump, there was not a majority support for either an increase or decrease.
Hmm.
Kasich supporters cut it a bit, $7 billion. Carson supporters, not too relevant now, cut it a few billion. Clinton supporters cut it $29 billion. A majority of Sanders supporters cut $68 billion. So there was significant variation, and there were variations in terms of the specific weapons programs. The supporters of Cruz, Rubio, and Trump majority opposed canceling the F-35, while the Clinton Sanders supporters favored it. So you know, they were acting in a way that was pretty consistent with their party overall.
Mm-hmm.
Given how much particularly the Republican candidates have been calling for defense increases, it's quite interesting that even their supporters and don't
right.
calling for that.
Another important piece of work, Stephen Cull, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Stephen Cull, founder and president of Voice of the People, the latest one, Right-Sizing Defense, the Perspective of the People. If you would like to take the survey, and who wouldn't, go to VOP.org, and you'll be able to do so and then send your survey result to your member of Congress. Thanks also to Bradley Penniston, deputy editor of Defense One. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio. Very interesting hour ahead. Stay with us.